Well, you could eat their ears.
We'll call to order the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is the 18th of March, and we've got a few items posted on our schedule. We've got two possible work sessions. We have three possible work sessions posted, two public hearings. We will be carrying over the work session on Senate Bill 478 to Monday, so that will be reposted for Monday. I'm just not ready to let my baby go out of my committee yet. So we'll be carrying that over. So if you're here for that bill, feel free to go. We won't be doing anything with it today. And don't get too excited, Senator Olson. Well, although I am giving you a few extra days to prepare.
That's right, absolutely.
And you can give your presentation to all those Klamath water users that'll be here on Monday.
Don't let them go.
For the hearings. Senator Thompson?
Well, you said I could go.
No, he didn't.
Oh, yeah, because you were here for 478. Yeah, okay. We've got a full committee now, so we're going to work a couple of bills. We'll go from there. So we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 256. Beth, what do we got here?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 256, there's a no revenue impact and a fiscal statement issued for the purpose of adding a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. The bill itself authorizes ODA to adopt certification standards for persons dealing in nursery stock. It increases the maximum license fee for growers. It increases the maximum amount of annual license fee for Christmas tree growers as well. And there is a dash two amendment in front of you that authorizes ODA to establish an expedited permitting process for people affected by the wildfire nursery stock statutes that participate and meet standards of ODA certification program, and it increases the maximum license fee for growers from $20,000 to $40,000 and the maximum millage rate from no more than 5 to 10.
And could you remind me, was testimony on the dash twos at the last, at the public hearing?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I believe that they discussed the contents of it, but they submitted the request and we didn't get it back, I think, until after the public.
Okay. If I could just get head nods at everybody that was here that testified on it before, everybody's okay, everybody's feeling okay with this. Okay. Great. I'd take a motion.
You're on.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 256, dated 3/16/2015.
Senator Olson's moved adoption of the dash two amendments, dated 3/16/2015, to Senate Bill 256. Is there any discussion?
I would only like to say, Mr. Chair, that I'm never really excited about fee increases, but when the groups themselves want them, they should get what they want.
Okay. Any other discussion? Seeing no discussion, are there any objections to adoption of the dash twos?
No.
That's an affirmative non-objection.
Yeah.
Okay. Seeing no objections, so ordered.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Olson has moved Senate Bill 256 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on the motion? Seeing no discussion. Are there any objections?
No.
Seeing no objections, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make notice of a possible minority report.
Seriously?
Close the work session.
No,
I'm going to close the work session. It's going to Ways and Means. So I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 256. And we've got one more quick work session, and then I will be handing the gavel over to Vice Chair Olson while Senator Thompson and I go testify on a bill, and then we'll be back. I want to report back from the committee if he pulls any shenanigans.
It'll be on tape.
Okay.
We'll just walk out.
Okay. So we're going to open up a – now we're going to open up a work session. Or did I close the work session?
Yeah.
I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 267.
267?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 267, there's a no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact statement issued on the Dash 1 amendment. The bill itself requires Water Resources Department to report to the 85th Legislative Assembly regarding the pilot program allowing specified irrigation districts and water control districts to temporarily transfer water use to another location within the district. Extends the duration of the pilot project to January 2nd, 2022. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that the water being transferred can only be used for irrigation, and it requires the Water Resources Department to post certain notice, and it requires them to annually publish notice of the districts intending to use the project, pilot project, prior to commencement.
Okay. Great.
Chair Edwards, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 3-4-2015.
Senator Olson moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 3-4-2015. Is there any discussion on Dash 1s? Are there any objections? You object?
Yeah.
Okay. So note for the record the objection of Senator Thompson to the Dash 1s, and the amendment, the adoption of the amendment passes. And Senator Olson.
Chair Edwards, I move Senate Bill 267 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 267 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Thompson?
No, just a no.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, are there any objections? Senator Thompson?
You've got,
okay, note for the record, Senator Thompson's objection. The bill is passes and is on its way to the floor.
Senator Thompson, carry.
And I forgot to note a carrier on the last bill.
I'll carry.
Others going to Ways and Means.
That's going to Ways and Means. Thank you. This bill, Senator Olson, you want to carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay, Senator Olson will carry. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 267 and pass the gavel over, and Senator Thompson and I will be back.
Welcome to.
Okay, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 202. And Beth, if you'd like to tell us what that is about.
Committee members, Senate Bill 202 requires the establishment of the Oregon Academy of Sciences as a nonprofit corporation to serve as the principal source of scientific investigation, examination, and reporting on scientific questions. Referred to it by the Academy, or excuse me, by the Governor, the Governor's designee, or the Legislative Assembly. There is a Dash 1 amendment in front of you that I think the proponents will discuss.
Do we have a list? Lori Onan with the Interim Natural Resource Policy Advisor from the Governor's Office. Hi, Lori. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you and good afternoon, Chair Olson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lori Onan with the Office of Governor Kate Brown, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify today. And we've got the slides up good. We're proposing a task force in Senate Bill 202, and the task force would develop recommendations to the legislature and the governor on independent science review for natural resource issues. And so what I'm going to cover today in a few brief slides is why we're proposing Senate Bill 202, an overview of the Dash 1 amendments, and we are working with stakeholders on additional amendments, and we've been having very good conversations. So this slide is why Senate Bill 202. Well, we've had it independent science review in Oregon for a while, and it can help inform decision around natural resource policies. And on this slide, you'll see some of the history we've had in Oregon. In 1997, the legislature created the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, and it was focused on the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed. So really that group was focusing on salmon and stream restoration science review. I would point out, I made an error on the slide. The IMST, that's the acronym, has also reported to the legislature in response to legislator requests, and I mistakenly did not include that. So they've reported to agencies, the governor, and the legislature. I put on the slide the Institute for Natural Resources because that's also a body that was created by the legislature in 2001. It is housed in Oregon State University, and it is not convened for the purpose of science review, but in fact, at the request, again, of agencies, and the governor has convene panels of scientists to respond to some questions about science review and natural resources issues. So that is also something that's happened in Oregon. And then agencies may contract with scientists to inform policy decisions, or agencies can convene science volunteer advisory committees. There also are, of course, examples in other states and federally. So Senate Bill 202 was introduced as a starting point to start the discussion on how to update independent science review for a broad range of natural resource issues. Again, it sets up a task force to advise the governor, and it also repeals the 1997 statute that created the independent multidisciplinary science team. I want to really say the governor's office recognizes and values the work of the IMST members over the past 15 years. They've done excellent work. However, when you look at the statutory responsibilities, it's very narrowly focused on salmon and streams, and we think it's important to have a broader range of looking at natural resources issues in science. And I just pointed out the independent, not subject to the control of others. That's actually a Webster's Online Dictionary definition, and I only pointed it out because it's something that has come up in the conversations with stakeholders about. That's an important factor here, but and you know, really defining what that means in the task force would be something they'd be looking at. So this is a slide of some of the things we were thinking about when drafting the Dash 1 amendments. First of all, Senate Bill 202, as introduced, was modeled on the Washington state legislation that created a nonprofit Washington Academy of Sciences. When we were doing research on how that's working, we learned it's been a struggle for them to raise funds, and currently they can do about one study a year. And so one of the things we're thinking about is how to leverage existing organizations that have already have staff and resources to make limited state funds go further, and having some existing organizations convene scientist panels depending on the issue. This doesn't rule out the idea of a nonprofit organization to be considered by the task force, but we wanted to keep options on the table. So the Dash 1 amendments look at not just a nonprofit, but other options, including the Institute for Natural Resources has come up as an idea. It's obviously very important that the science review have an open process that people can feel confident in, but we want to make sure it's independent because I think that would make a difference to people's perception of it. And we want to enhance the involvement of Oregon's universities. And then the last slide today is I really do appreciate the feedback from interested stakeholders in Senate Bill 202. The additional amendments we're working on would make it clear that the task force would look at all options and issues, and the amendments would expand the task force to make sure the people that have interest in this topic are at the table and bring scientific policy and practical considerations to the conversation. And with that, that was it, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions? Senator Denver?
No, I'd just like to make a comment, if I could. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this, and I mentioned this yesterday to Lori when she came and visited, this really reminds me of a conversation that we're having in another setting that the presiding officers convened a group to look at perhaps to our creating a policy office here in the legislature, which would be able to do issues of policy in an independent, nonpartisan kind of way, and you know, would serve us in that capacity. And it would be the where the, you know, the current thinking of the group, they put together a bipartisan, bicameral group to work on this, and that, you know, the current thinking is that it would be overseen by a committee, a policy committee, which again would be a, you know, a joint bipartisan, bicameral committee, which would take requests for research and would then sort of triage them. And some of them, most of them ideally would be done in-house through policy staff, including committee services staff. When they have time, they would be part of that. But some of them would need to be sent out to universities for, you know, for work there, things that were above the level of expertise or complexity of this office. So I think, you know, what's being discussed here is very much in line of, you know, efforts to meet a perceived need, which is some kind of, you know, independent review, something that we could all, that we could trust, that would come to us in a non-biased manner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Laurie, the funding, I understand once you get up and trying to get the funding going to maintain, but for the work that would be needed to be done through this work group, is that contemplated to needing funding from the legislature or what?
Chair Olson, Senator Pruszynski, very good question. There has been a history of funding provided to the independent multidisciplinary science team through the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board budget, and that's happened for many years. Currently, that budget has dollars in it for this work under this, to move forward with this independent update of the independent science review. So that's what the governor's office had proposed.
Any follow-up?
Sure.
So understanding from what Senator Denbrough was talking about is to having some type of institution that would be able to give us as the legislature more independent analysis. This really, from your presentation, is going to be more limited as to its application. So the disciplines are going to be mainly in the field of sciences.
Chair Olson, Senator Pruszynski, yes, the focus of this is to look at independent science to inform agencies, the legislature, the governor, perhaps others, when they're looking at natural resource policy decisions.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Laurie. I do have a question for you. When this, if this program is to be put together, could a legislature such as Senator Denbrough send you an email or a letter and say, I need some research on a specific natural resource policy, and you guys would be able to do that? Or is this going to be something where you need like 3 or 4 month lead time to put together?
Chair Olson, I think if you look at the way it's worked in the past, and this is why we'd want this task force to look at how it's worked in the past and how it should work in the future, there has been a question posed by the legislature or governor or an agency. The science, you figure out who the people are, who are the experts on that issue. They will get in and they may have questions about the question. And so they might say, well, you know, we need to refine the question, or we need to clarify the question. And so it has taken some time. It hasn't been a very quick turnaround. It's at least several months. But again, that's something that I think the task force would be looking at as to how can this work? What's the best value we can get out of this? If we're going to continue this work, how does that look like, and what's the process?
I think this is something that it could work wonderfully, but I think it needs to be timely, because committee chairs set an agenda 2, 3, maybe 4 weeks out, and it's difficult to get a response back on a technical issue unless the chair was able to say, hey, folks, this is what we're going to do in the future. Anybody want to go to that place and get some information on it? So I think I as I talked to in my office, I support this, because I believe in good scientific information and background to make good informed decisions. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up on yours. It almost would seem, though, you'd have to have under the terms of a gatekeeper, somebody that's going to be taking the request in. There may be some things that they could basically pull off the shelf that may already have been there to help us doing some of the stuff. But I really see this as being more of a longer-term type of policy analysis as compared to a quick turnaround. Now, I don't know if you have looked at other states and other nonprofits that serve this function. If you can give us maybe a little bit more just for the record as to how it would be able to be applied for us in a short-term turnaround as compared to having an interim work group pose the question. It's like the Law Commission, how the Judiciary Committee and this body will give something that may be a year project or more that has that independent knowledge base that they're putting their best minds together.
And Chair Olson, Senator Pruszynski, appreciate the question. Some of the models that are out there, I think that the ability to turn it around quickly would probably depend on whether you're going to look at an existing body of science. There's a lot of science out there, and you could get the right people in the room to kind of synthesize that and provide you with quick summaries of what it's telling, versus you're going to dig more deeply and try to say, okay, what should the state be thinking about when it's making some particular decision. So I think it would depend on the issue and the question, but that's something to look at, certainly.
And if I could follow up, and you know, going back to the model that we've been looking at in the policy committee, you know, for shorter term kinds of issues, things where we'd like to get answers within a few weeks or a month, we would use in-house staff for that. And then for the longer, more in-depth, sort of like the Oregon Law Center kinds of things, the big questions that are enduring with us. And I will say, interestingly, that all the examples that came up in this policy group were natural resource issues, issues of controversy. And, you know, those would be the ones that would probably wind up being farmed out. And, again, it would be this joint legislative committee that would do the triage on that because, you know, we have limited resources and our experts have limited time. But I will say that the other issue that came up is that the legislature needs its own research. You know, we depend so much on advocates and lobbyists and even the executive branch information from the agencies, which, you know, sometimes can come to us with a certain agenda attached. And so we need something that is, you know, geared to us.
Perhaps, and I guess the last question for this panelist would be, if this is a very important program, we could give it to you, and we, the legislature, could put that legislation off for a year to let you get the information we need before we pass something forward, rather than we have to do it in 2 weeks or 3 weeks.
Unless it's one of my bills.
Absolutely. If there's no further questions, we will move on to the next panelist, Lisa Gaines, Tom Wolf, and Joe Rolliter. Thank you. Lisa, would you like to go first?
Thank you, I will. Chair Olson and committee members, it's very nice to be here. Thank you for having me, and please forgive my voice. I'm one of the many Oregonians fighting a cold this time of year.
Oh.
My name is Lisa Gaines. My name is Lisa Gaines, and I direct the Institute for Natural Resources, and we are headquartered at Oregon State University. And as Lori mentioned, we were put in place by the legislature in 2001, primarily with the aim of helping bring the scientific expertise of the universities into interdisciplinary natural resources issues and decision-making. With the roles that we were given, and as designated in our legislature, we translated those in primarily four categories of work that we do. One is to provide access to manage, and to develop data and integrated information. For instance, in one area we house is with the Oregon Explorer and Natural Resources Digital Library. We provide technical assistance and analysis to agencies and others who come to us to help them develop tools for natural resources decision making. We manage large projects and coordinate research across the universities themselves. And we also convene and synthesize science based on really looking at existing science. What does the state of the science say for large scientific issues and natural resources issues? And our interest in this is just to be able to help out in any way we can, if that is supporting the task force as it makes its decisions and recommendations, and if directed to be able to help out with the scientific review process. Thank you for your time.
Vice Chair Olson, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I sent my testimony in earlier. It's on OLIS. Hopefully you've had a chance to read it. I just want to reiterate some of the things that were said there. Trout Unlimited does support this bill. We think it's a great bill. We support the Dash 1 amendments. One of the things that really drives anything you do with conservation is science. We have currently a staff of about 15 scientists that advise TU policy. The senior scientist for that, Jack Williams, is down in Medford. So everything we do is driven by science. But we also, whenever we do make, before we ever release a policy statement, we run it by independent science teams that we contract with, because we want to make sure that our science is just not driven by our policy. So I think the concept of having an independent science review team that can look at agency stuff, that can advise legislators and their staff is a great idea. We support where the task force will be going with this, so we think it's a great concept, and we encourage it as it moves along. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I represent Seafood Oregon. We support this bill. We think there's a need for an independent scientific review team of some kind to be able to answer these questions for us, for the legislature, for agencies, for the governor's office that are continually coming up with the things that I deal with. Senator Prezansky will remember back to the whatever it's called, the Joint Committee on Salmon and Streams, I think, which originally came up with this idea. And so the committee recognized that you needed somebody independent that you could go, and so they created the IMST. And I think the questions that you all asked, Lori Annan, a little while ago, kind of are the kinds of questions that I've always had about the IMST and how it works. And so I think having a task force and getting some folks to come and talk about their experience with the IMST and with these kinds of big scientific questions would be really good. So thank you very much.
Thank you each. Questions?
Yeah. Ms. Gaines, could you give me an idea of the types of projects you work on and the turnaround that you are able to provide?
Absolutely. A lot of the projects that we have worked on with science reviews, and as opposed to the other types of projects we do, have tended to be about 6 months or so, 6 months to a year. In following what the National Research Council does, and that is the operating arm of the National Academy of Sciences, they tend to see, depending on the type of question asked, reviews can take anywhere from 6 to 12 months. To engage in. The types of projects we are doing, for instance, we are engaged with the state of California, the state of Washington, and British Columbia with the West Coast Scientific Panel for Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia. And we have making sure that we get questions that are asked by managers, state, and federal agencies to these scientists. There are about 18 of them to make sure how can we actually answer these questions? Is there a scientific basis for these questions? Does the literature exist? If it does not exist, what do we do? In the meantime, what is the settled science? That's one. We are working with the U.S. Geological Survey, their Northwest Climate Science Center, and we have a project with them called the Assessment of Available Science Project, the ASAP project, and to try to look at getting scientists together. It's almost an experiment in two ways, which is the best way to utilize scientists in science reviews, and how can we actually set up a process for doing systematic reviews, very much documenting the information, making it available for folks to use. This is a project that we, the USGS, were actually asking, can we do it on a short timeline? So we are on basically an exploration to see how short of a timeline can we get relevant information to them. The point for this process is to look at how long does it take, not necessarily the complete results, because when we have shortened time, sometimes that limits our ability to get all the gray literature, the literature that might come out of agencies, that might come out of NGOs, et cetera. So we put defining tasks on that. So that's an experiment we're getting in currently.
Yeah.
How were you tasked with these? Did the governor send this project to you, or did a legislator send this project to you?
With the projects that we get with the USGS Climate Science Center, it was a grant that we were awarded. With the West Coast Scientific Panel for Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia, we were asked to do this, and it came from several state agencies and the governor's office and the vice president for research at Oregon State University. Right. But oftentimes it's agencies that come to us requesting it, and we negotiate a question.
So, follow up?
Yeah. Question.
So then if we, the legislative body, one or two of us or whatever, get together, we can come up with we see something on the horizon, we say, can you put together some scientific information on this and what would be the results? Would you have the capacity to do that for just a small little thing, or do these have to be grandiose projects that you work on?
Thank you very much, Chair Olson, for asking. That's a great question. The way we currently operate, we are soft funded, meaning we are primarily funded through grants and contracts. So we would have to figure out our negotiation with this. When we do our science review, it's not necessarily us internal to the Institute for Natural Resources who engages in the work. We find the researchers or the specialists within the Oregon University system first, now Oregon Public Universities, and outside to be able to answer questions. So depending on the availability, we would have to negotiate that and let you know. When it comes to the future, if this were to move forward, I believe the task force would be able to tell us how that would operate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay.
Thank you each for being here.
Next, call up Mike Freese, Heath Curtis, and Jenny Dressler.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I just want to say for the record that Vice Chair Olson did a remarkably good job while you were gone.
It was the subject of some discussion at my hearing.
We actually saw that you had someone come in and observing just to make certain.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a coordinated effort to keep me down there as long as possible, so I knew that something must be going on down here.
We did good.
I'm just giving you a bad time. Okay, great. Go ahead. Awesome. Whoever wants to start.
I'll start. Thanks. Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. It is my understanding that Senate Bill 202 was drafted to respond to a need within the administrative and legislative arenas for an independent scientific review body in Oregon on natural resource issues. As amended, Senate Bill 202 would eliminate the Independent Multidisciplinary Science Team, or the IMST, and provide for a task force to evaluate the role the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University could play in providing the independent scientific review functions desired by the state. Oregon Farm Bureau has expressed some concerns with limiting the evaluation to the Institute for Natural Resources and essentially pre-selecting it as a peer review board without first evaluating whether independent scientific review is needed in Oregon and, if so, whether the Institute for Natural Resources is the correct entity to fill that function given their existing priorities and structure. Oregon Farm Bureau requests that the task force look at factors more sequentially in evaluating how to proceed with independent scientific review. First, the task force should evaluate whether there is a need for an independent scientific review process in Oregon's natural resources arena. Second, the task force should evaluate whether there are any existing entities or institutions that could administer an independent scientific review program, and if so, what changes would be necessary to ensure that the selected institution can properly take on those functions. Third, the task force should look at what the process should be for agencies and legislators to utilize the recommended independent scientific review program. Oregon Farm Bureau believes that these changes to the task force will help ensure that any state scientific review process is well constructed, free from bias, and able to meet the state's needs. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill.
Thank you. Mike.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Freese representing AOI. Generally speaking, AOI supports Senate Bill 202 and kind of the goals of updating the process and reviewing opportunities for truly independent review, scientific review, including discontinuing the independent multidisciplinary science team. That's a mouthful. However, we do have concerns with Senate Bill 202, and we also have concerns with the -1 amendment, although we think that gets us closer to where we're going. And quite frankly, I think that with a little bit more time, we'll be able to find an agreement on amendment that will work for everyone. And I think this will be a little bit duplicative of what Ms. Dressler said, but we do have a few issues with predetermining the group. It's not we don't have any doubts that INR is a good institution or maybe the best institution to do this. We just want the task force to actually look at whether we need a separate entity than our agencies or something that's really state-sponsored to do this review, or if there's a process in place that we can utilize now without having to create some special group to do it. And again, that may be INR, I don't know. But again, I think having a task force look at the necessity, and then what, and then basing a recommendation on that necessity, what is the best group to do independent scientific review, and then also what's the best process to send projects to this group. So is it the legislature, is it through the governor's office, or some other way to kind of remove some of the politics that can cloud the perception of an independent review. So based on that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Heath?
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm here with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. Just a couple comments. First, I'd like to commend Ms. Anand. She's reached out deliberately to a variety of stakeholders, including OFIC, and sought out our input. And I think the product is improving as a result. I would say that science is hard, right? In natural resources in particular, sometimes we're dealing with, for instance, endangered species where they're really elusive and we don't actually know a lot about them, right? And so you can have two scientists at the same table telling you very different things. If this institution or this body is going to be useful, I think we want to be deliberate about it. The trick here to me isn't making it purely independent. The trick is making it a body that people buy into, right? That they actually are going to listen to the results and that it's not just another voice in the shouting match. I would encourage you to look to the bill in that vein. We're working on further amendments to make sure that the stakeholders, the variety, large diversity of stakeholders, buy into the process and that the state produces a useful product. So thanks for taking my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions?
I do have a question to the panel. So, it sounds to me that, like, the kinds of concerns that you're raising, the kinds of questions that you're raising, are those that would be addressed by the task force. And that's what this bill is designed to do, is to create a task force to find answers to that. So it seems as if we're on the right track here.
Chedward, Senator Dembrough, I agree. The bill actually outlines a number of questions that the task force is to address. We want to ensure that list of questions and the concepts include some of the things we mentioned today. But I think you're right. This is precisely why you would have a task force to inform the ultimate body.
So you're officially opposed or neutral? I heard concerns. We have a sign-up sheet. None of you marked against. You all marked neutral.
Yep.
So I'm wondering, are you I understand your concerns. I get it.
So
I'm trying to figure out, are you neutral or opposed?
So
I think almost to yes.
We're almost to yes, I think. We're working through amendments to get to yes. And again, we do think that this is a good idea. We just want to make sure that the task force is charged with the right questions so that we can get the right answers.
I'll accept almost to yes as being good enough. Okay. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Right. I just want to understand.
Then he stopped
listening.
I
heard opposition, but I saw neutral. So I'm like, I'm just trying to figure out. Almost a yes is a good enough proxy.
I heard some trepidation because your concerns of neutrality. When you sit up where we sit, I mean, we get both sides of the story, and it's hard to believe which one is the right one. And I would like to have that ability to go to an unbiased group and say, hey, this is important. What are the real answers so that I can trust them? Because I used to be in sales, and my product was always better than everybody else's. And the question is, from the other side, how much better is theirs than mine? And we have to determine that. And without a scientific basis or a basis to lay a foundation on and say, okay, this is what we've got, it's difficult for us to make intelligent decisions, which sometimes we don't do because we don't know. And I think this is a great program, and there are concerns, obviously, but I think that can be worked out in a group to figure out, how we can get to a place where we can have a group of people that we can get an answer from, we can actually trust. It's just my two cents.
I was going to say one last thing. This, one of the things that I find really appealing about this proposal is the role that it asks our public universities to play. because this is, you know, one important part of the mission of our universities is to advise us on matters of public policy. That's why we send them, you know, the billions of dollars that we do every year. That's very facetious. I'm hoping we can send them more. We have incredible talent at our universities and, you know, research expertise of national proportions. And, you know, I've always felt that we could be tapping that expertise in a more sustained manner. So that is also something that really appeals to me.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you each for being here. Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 202 that has not signed up to testify on Senate Bill 202? Okay, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 202, and we are going to open up our final hearing of the day, opening a hearing on Senate Bill 829. And while Beth tells us what the measure does, call Keith Curtis to get us started.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 829 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt by rule a methodology for assessing waters of the state pursuant to the Federal Water Pollution Control Act, and it requires DEQ's assessment and follow-up assessments to be consistent with that methodology.
Oh, did we have a panel here? So there are some other people. Do you want other folks to come up at the same time?
Sure, that's great.
Or do you want to have own the spotlight for a few minutes?
Chair, at your discretion.
Give me a bad time. I want Mike and Jenny. Why don't you come up as well? I know.
Got to change seats, though. You got to change seats.
I should have been looking ahead and just had them sit there. So.
Thanks.
Yeah, why'd you leave? Yeah.
No, it's
burning calorie here.
I put it in. It's a committee bill. Go ahead.
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Heath Curtis, and I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. We're supportive of Senate Bill 829, and it addresses a pointy-headed administrative law question that has presented some problems for us recently. So if I may, I included some materials for you, both on OLIS and printed. It may help you to follow along. But before we get to those, it's important to understand a couple things. This is with regard to the Clean Water Act, right? With regard to the Clean Water Act, it's important to know that the Environmental Quality Commission adopts rules, and the Department of Environmental Quality does not have independent rulemaking authority. So that's just kind of a setup. So the Clean Water Act is structured such that states are supposed to designate uses on water bodies, so it'd be things like salmon rearing. Then they are supposed to set water quality standards sufficient to protect those designated uses. And then they're supposed to go out and look across the state at all the different water bodies and decide whether or not they meet those water quality standards. That's the basic premise. Those water quality standards themselves, as you can imagine, can drive a lot of policy. They can drive a lot of what happens on the ground. So much so that the Clean Water Act actually requires that the EPA approve or disapprove of water quality standards before they're implemented. So when the Environmental Quality Commission adopts a water quality standard, it goes to the EPA for their approval. If in fact EPA disapproves it, then they write their own water quality standard. So in the past, the state has adopted, the Environmental Quality Commission has adopted some really broad and ambiguous water quality standards. One of them's in your packet. It's actually on the back of the first page. This is the biocriteria standard. And if I may, it's a single sentence long. It says, waters of the state must be of sufficient quality to support aquatic species without detrimental changes in the resident biological communities. Now, I'm not entirely certain what that means. If I go and I look at a water body and try and analyze, is this of sufficient quality to support aquatic species, that's really difficult to say, right? There's going to be further analysis involved. This is true of a lot of water quality standards. Many of them, even when they have numeric criteria, you can go out there and say, this is the number that we want to see for copper or ammonia or any of a number of other items. And it still requires saying, how are we going to measure that number, right? And so there is some implementation necessary in the application of water quality standards to any individual water body. However, recently, DEQ has decided to start implementing some of these very ambiguous and broad water quality standards. So that biocriteria standard, I printed out the whole thing. You can see it was its history. It was initially adopted in 1991. Well, in 2010, DEQ published in connection with its biennial review. So it's, recall, every 2 years, the state goes out to look at these water bodies and decide whether or not they're impaired or not, whether they're meeting water quality standards. In 2010, and I've included in your packet the 2012 copy because it's identical, they included a methodology for the biocriteria standard. So if you turn your page, you can see here there's four pages of text associated with the biocriteria standard, and you can see at the very end, table 7, that's on the last page of your printout, this is the benchmarks, as DEQ would style them, for analyzing whether or not a stream is meeting the biocriteria standard. So recall that the biocriteria standard actually speaks to aquatic species without detrimental changes in the resident biological communities. So what DEQ did is they picked out and they said, well, some of the resident biological communities could be benthic macroinvertebrates. These are kind of bugs that live in the soil and the water. They would say, well, do we have impaired benthic macroinvertebrates or not? How are we going to know? So they devised this plan where they would go look at reference conditions in, like, wilderness areas, say, what do we see there, and then go look at other water bodies in the state and say, do we see what we see in the reference conditions, kind of these observed versus expected indices. More than that, in the benchmarks, they actually put some numbers, and they said, for instance, in the marine western coastal forest, if you go look at your non-wilderness, right, stream, and you have greater than equal to a 15% taxa loss, that's the kind of bugs, the number of kinds of bugs, then that stream is going to be designated water quality limited as category 5. That means it requires a TMDL. That means it sets off a large process to try and fix a problem that may exist there. It doesn't necessarily dictate what the pollutant is or the reason that it's impaired, but it does mark it as impaired and mark it as needing a TMDL. Well, that 15% number, that's not really a science number per se, right? Who's to say that 15% loss or 20% loss or 18% loss, that that's the right number, right? That is in itself a kind of policy call, and it has ramifications, like, in terms of large expenditures for the state setting about on TMDLs. What is impaired given what we know about the science here? And this is another example where some scientists have competing views about whether sediment, for instance, impairs these aquatic communities. In our mind, that's not a decision that should be made in a methodology document. In fact, this is a perfect example of what a water quality standard usually looks like. They usually include these numbers. Instead, what happened is they were published in the methodology document for the 303D list. We were given, I believe, a 30-day comment period. We commented, we didn't like this. This should be adopted by rule. In fact, we think it is a rule. We didn't get a lot of traction with that, and it was sent to EPA, and EPA is more than happy to approve it. Now, while we could litigate whether or not this is a rule or not, EPA doesn't have to observe a procedural error at state law. When the state sends them a list of water bodies that the state believes are impaired, they largely listen. In this context, we're concerned that these one-sentence water quality standards should not be implemented by staff at a relatively low level with very specific numeric thresholds. Those require policy decisions that should appropriately be made by the Environmental Quality Commission with a robust opportunity for public input. You may be asking yourself, are there other examples of this? One would be the turbidity standard. There's something similar is there. Notwithstanding the numeric criteria for turbidity, the DEQ has also identified that greater than 45 days at more than 5 NTU would be impairment. And as a harbinger of things to come, there's also a sedimentation, a sediment standard in Oregon that's narrative. It's very broad. But in the methodology document that was printed in 2012, DEQ indicated that DEQ is currently reviewing approaches to apply a numeric benchmark based on measurements of stream conditions to implement the narrative criteria. We know what's coming on sediment, too. And again, numbers involve policymaking, which is appropriately done by the Environmental Quality Commission, not inside of DEQ. So that's the reason for the bill. The bill would say that this methodology document here would have to be adopted by rule. Now, there's always going to be some implementation associated with it, but the bill says specifically, including any numeric interpretation of narrative standards, and that's a very important language to us. This should be done by rule, by the EQC, with an opportunity for robust public involvement. With that, Chair Edwards, I apologize for the lengthy description, and it's kind of dry, but it's very important to us and has had real ramifications very recently.
Yeah, no, don't apologize. It was a helpful description. Jenny?
So, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. I appreciate the opportunity to follow up on Heath's comments today. I would like to join my colleagues in their support of this bill. Senate Bill 829 makes it clear that the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act requires an agency to engage in rulemaking when it adopts numeric criteria that will be used to list waters as water quality, or as water quality limited under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act. This bill provides a clear directive to DEQ that will help clarify its obligations to make its processes public and will ensure transparency of processes for listing waters. Additionally, requiring numeric criteria to be adopted through rule will encourage DEQ to engage with interested parties earlier in the process of developing its methodology for assessing waters and give the impacted parties a public forum under which they can ask relevant questions and, if necessary, challenge DEQ's methodology of translating narrative standards into numeric standards. The DEQ has previously opted to circumvent the required rulemaking process when it develops methodology to turn narrative criteria into numeric criteria. This legislation closes that loophole and helps ensure that DEQ's processes are transparent and open to the public. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill today, and I welcome any questions that you may have.
Mike?
Chair Edwards, for the record, Mike Fries, representing AOI. I think Heath covered most of the, most of the topic, but I think from AOI's perspective, first, we support Senate Bill 829. But it's important that when the agency sets such important policy decisions and even scientific ones around water quality standards, that those are done in an open forum and adopted by the EQC, not simply by staff. SB 829 provides that the EQC shall adopt by rule these methodologies, as explained by Heath. The purpose for the process outlined in this bill is to ensure that the appointed EQC members, not agency staff, are making important policy decisions that affect many of our members. Like the legislature, when issues are brought in front of the EQC, business and other interested parties have an opportunity to present a case, evidence, and other scientific analysis before a rule is adopted. And right now, we do not have that same opportunity when DEQ just simply puts it in their without going through the rulemaking process. So in essence, this ensures that DEQ follows a more thorough process that involves more stakeholders before it establishes a water quality standard and submits it to EPA. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Questions? No questions.
No, thank you.
I'm surprised you, didn't I? Okay.
Chair Edwards,
if
I may,
please.
Very quickly, anticipating some comments coming up, I would say that there is an argument that by adopting the methodology by rule, that may expose the state to further litigation surrounding those numeric benchmarks, right? From our perspective, that's a fair trade. The alternative for us is that there's no opportunity to interject, and that these standards are implemented in methodology documents as opposed to being adopted by the EQC. So that is to say, though there may be an opportunity for people to disagree, I think that's precisely the reason to do this. That is, it's important and controversial decision making that's appropriately done by policymakers.
Yeah, I do have a question. So in your experience, is Oregon an outlier here? I mean, compared to our neighbors to the north and south, do they tend to do this thing by, you know, in more detail with numerical standards by rule?
Chair Edwards, Senator Denbrough, every state that I'm familiar with actually includes a methodology document with their integrated report describing how they're implementing their standards. I would say it's also the case that you're almost always going to need that document. What's unique here is not necessarily the methodology document itself. It's taking very vague single sentence water quality standards and assigning numeric thresholds in a table. That is not necessarily a product of the methodology document. It's a product of how we're applying those water quality standards in Oregon. And yes, I do believe that's unique. And to me, it's a question of good governance, and it's not appropriate.
Okay. Any questions?
No, thank you.
Thanks. Call up DEQ. I'm not sure who, Jennifer and Palmer, I guess. So.
They have names, you know.
I know, but I saw Jennifer, and I didn't know Palmer was going to come up also. So
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative coordinator with the Department of Environmental Quality. And the reason, Chair Edwards, you didn't see is I forgot to sign up. I didn't make it over to the sign-up sheet, so that's why I'm not listed there. But I wanted to kick things off. Jennifer Weigel, who is our water quality program manager, is going to provide the bulk of the testimony today. So without any further ado, I'll turn it over to her.
Good afternoon. So I just want to start off by saying that DEQ is taking no position on Senate Bill 829 at this time. We do have concerns with the bill that I'm going to share with you today. However, ultimately, we do have a goal of to resolve those legitimate issues raised by the stakeholders that you just heard. And before I proceed with my testimony, I do want to also make clear that DEQ takes those concerns raised by the stakeholders seriously. The listing of a water body as impaired and the subsequent effect on DEQ's regulatory activities can affect businesses and communities in significant ways. For this reason, it is understandable that stakeholders such as those who preceded us are concerned with how DEQ uses data for the purposes of assessing water quality data for attainment of water quality standards and that it would be of great interest to them. As part of my remarks, I will spend a minute to kind of put a finer point on Heath's comments about the distinguishing between water quality standards and the assessment methodology. Heath did a great job, so I won't spend too much time on that. You know, the assessment methodology, of course, is what the focus of this bill is. I'll also lay out some approaches that we think that we could take to address some of the concerns related to both in public involvement and also addressing concerns that have been raised about the scientific basis for these methods. So first, with regard to water quality standards, they do represent the level of water quality necessary to protect uses. Those uses for any given water body can span from protecting salmon to consuming fish, protecting sources of drinking water to industrial uses, hydropower, the gamut of uses that are to be made of our surface waters. The Environmental Quality Commission, as our rulemaking body, does adopt water quality standards as rules. That's required of all states in adopting their water quality standards to have those adopted as rules. Our water quality standards do ensure that the most sensitive of those uses are protected. In most cases, that intends to be fish and fish or the aquatic community as a whole, or human. So for things like consumption of fish or exposure to bacteria, things like that in surface waters while recreating. Most standards are numeric values. So for example, an example would be dissolved oxygen shouldn't exceed X milligrams per liter during the winter to protect salmon, or Y milligrams per liter in the summer. Some of our standards are narrative in nature. They do. They are often used when water quality can't be precisely measured, or there's a lot of variability in what's protective at a particular location throughout the state, and also can be used also when the objective is to prevent a condition. So a couple of examples, we do have a narrative standard that says that water shall be free from algal growths that are harmful to fish or people. So people may recall the large harmful algal bloom we had last summer in the Willamette River. No toxic pollutants in toxic amounts. And so then this other piece, so the assessment methodologies. So those methodologies we use to be able to determine whether or not a water body or a part of a water body is not meeting standards. And so, as was previously mentioned, we are required to do that assessment for all surface waters of the state every 2 years. And then we're supposed to determine which of those waters are meeting standards and which are not meeting standards. We must start by first collecting all available data. That's included in the Clean Water Act. That's a requirement for us. So anybody who has data that's usable to us, we need to assemble that. We need to start by assembling it. And then we use the methodology to use to guide how we evaluate that data against the standards. And so we recognize evaluating the data may seem straightforward. I mean, the concept is pretty straightforward. We are basically trying to figure out whether or not the concentration of a pollutant is higher or lower than the standard allows. But in a lot of cases, it is not that simple for a few reasons. One key reason is not all the data may agree. So some show the standard might be being met, and other data points say it isn't. We may have data for some portions of a stream, but much less in other portions. Or we may only have a few data points that are really spread out across the length of a stream. And so we have to have a method that helps us and documents how we will decide which parts of a stream are meeting the standard and which aren't. Data is often collected using different methods. So for example, it's very common to go out and you probably, when you think about collecting data, you go out and you see a person and they're dipping in their jar and they're collecting a sample and they take it back to the laboratory. That's one method. It's called a grab sample. We also have other methods where we actually have devices in the stream that record things like dissolved oxygen and temperature every 15 minutes, which can give us good insight for things that vary over the course of a day, like dissolved oxygen and temperature. And we may have both of those in a data set and figuring out how do we reconcile those different kinds of data that represent different conditions. And so when narrative standards are involved, the evaluation of data is more complicated even. And so we must consider the appropriate science and scientific methods in order to do those kinds of evaluation. And these, as you might imagine, the methods for being able to collect this data and to evaluate the data do evolve over time. Our laboratory methods get more sophisticated, our data sets get larger, and our analytical techniques do improve. One thing I also want to make sure that I do is to stress the confidence that we have in our agency's ability and expertise to analyze data and to come to the best conclusion that we can in our assessment of water quality data. And we recognize that these analyses do lay the foundation for working with our partners to protect and restore Oregon's waters. And so with that background on the water quality standards and the role of the assessment methodology, I would like to turn back to the bill. As you know, Senate Bill 829 would require the Environmental Quality Commission to adopt these methods through rulemaking. We do think the bill as drafted could have some significant implications for DEQ's program. First, we think this would include an increased workload for DEQ. To keep up with the new information and data analysis methods, we do believe that would effectively result in continuous rulemaking in order to keep up with these changes. And it would also make it very challenging to meet our federal requirement that we produce an assessment every 2 years. We would also expect increased oversight by EPA and NOAA Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. In Florida, which is the only state we're aware of that has an assessment methodology adopted into rule, many of the methods in those instances have been determined to be water quality standards, have been brought under that umbrella, and have been subject to the same processes and oversight by EPA, which also includes Endangered Species Act consultation, which in our experience has lasted up to 10 years, in some cases, on our water quality standards rules. Florida's experience has found this approach to be very time-consuming and litigious. In addition, as a result, we think this would significantly slow our assessment process and make it more difficult to produce timely information on water quality conditions. And so we believe some of these outcomes may be contrary to our understanding of the proponent's objectives, and we are definitely interested in discussing with them further how we can best achieve shared interests and outcomes. We do have some current, I want to spend a minute also just talking about our current process and plans. The current DEQ assessment process does include some public involvement, but we acknowledge it's limited. We have realized and acknowledged those concerns and questions regarding existing methods and our need to address those as we update the next methodology. What we haven't done yet, however, is to provide concerned stakeholders with a specific timeline or process for undertaking that work. We've been delayed by the need to complete work on the assessment process that was started in 2012. Our work there is mostly finished, and we are now turning our attention to improving many aspects of how we produce these assessments. What we are doing is we are starting with a master project plan to organize the issues and tasks and identify how we will sequence this work and begin to resolve issues. We have already notified EPA that we are taking a timeout from producing the next assessment until we address these issues. The goal of this program review and improvement process is to enable DEQ to produce a robust water quality assessment every 2 years that meets not only our federal requirements, but also provides a meaningful information to the public on the condition of Oregon's waters and is used to inform and guide water quality protection and restoration efforts in Oregon. We do have some potential options where we think that we could address some of these broad-ranging issues. And we are committed to providing an opportunity for stakeholder involvement in this process. Some of these options to improve public involvement specifically and also to engage experts in addressing issues of science policy include using external scientific input into specific aspects of the methodology as it's being revised. When we take water quality standards to our Environmental Quality Commission for adoption, we could include a more thorough discussion of how we would capture and address revisions in our methodology. We could also explicitly solicit early public comments on a draft methodology before we run the numbers to develop draft assessment conclusions. So those are a few things that we think that could address some of the issues that have been raised. In closing, we are interested in talking with the bill's proponents further to solicit their input on how best to involve them in the review of our assessment process and the application of the process in the future. As I stated at the outset, our goal is to resolve those legitimate issues that have been raised by stakeholders. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I have a question. So I heard, so I'm still getting up to speed really on all the, there's a lot here. Okay. So I heard on one hand, most states include, and I can't remember exactly what it was that Heath Curtis had said, they include something, and then you're saying, but on the other hand, Florida is the only one that does, I think you're asserting, that does what the bill does. So there's some sort of gap, and so I'm wondering if perhaps, and I'd actually like Heath to come back up here, and so you guys are gonna be nice to each other, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. I want to understand better exactly. Heath is asserting one thing, you're asserting something else, and I just want to make sure that I understand, or maybe you're not asserting different things. Okay. So I didn't understand. There's a gap in my understanding.
So, Chair Edwards, states are required to publish a methodology. So publish a methodology when they submit their list of assessment conclusions to EPA.
Okay.
So we are required, every state's required to publish this method document, however they package it up. Florida is the only state that I'm aware of that publishes that methodology in a rulemaking process. Other states publish it as a standalone document or whatever their other non-regulatory processes may guide them to do.
Okay.
Chair Edwards, I actually agree with Jennifer's description of that. I would say from our perspective, it's a really tough nut to crack what's appropriately a rule and what's appropriately guidance, just implementation of a rule. That's a hot topic, frankly, legally across the nation. I want to be clear, from our perspective, public stakeholder participation is one component of what we're looking for. The other component is that the Environmental Quality Commission, that is the policymakers themselves, are the ones who make these decisions about implementation of large, broad, ambiguous water quality standards, particularly when they involve numeric thresholds. And so in that light, I mean, what does need to go before the Environmental Quality Commission and what doesn't? That's a little tricky. I think that's something that we can get at here. I don't know that the bill proposes that we go all the way to what Florida is doing, and that is to run the whole methodology document past the rulemaking body. To the extent that DEQ has some thoughts about how we can run less than the entire methodology document past the EQC, we very much look forward to working with them on that, and I think we're all ears.
Okay. And then when you do the assessment every 2 years, then that has to be ratified by EQC or not? It doesn't. The assessment that's done per the methodology, that stands. The EQC doesn't look at it and say, okay, we have concerns about what you did over here, and it just stands.
And Chair Edwards, we would agree that the methodology itself is the map, as it were, for how you take millions of data points mm-hmm. and turn it into something that's comprehensible, mm-hmm. and having results, for any interested citizen, regulatory party, anybody who may be interested in the water quality conditions on a specific stream or creek, that's the roadmap for mm-hmm. how we get from one to the other. And so the results themselves are results. Hopefully I'm not speaking out of turn by saying the commission may not, mm-hmm. In terms of just seeing a list of streams and the results that we've concluded, they probably wouldn't be able to deduce much mm-hmm. from that. It is the map, is the methodology for really how we get from one, the inputs to the outputs.
Okay. And then I guess
it must be consistent with, right. It must be bookended by what our standards
and
say.
And is that fairly standard state to state? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I think I get what you're both saying. I do have a little bit of concern if there is so much if there is a lot of discretion in the field about whether or not I sample with the mason jar or I do a certain. I mean, I'm not a scientist myself. I imagine though that scientists have some sort of understanding that, well, if we sample this way or we sample this way, it's probably going to, going to show more of this or show more of that. And so I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that from a public process standpoint. I'm also sensitive to what the department has laid out, what you're faced with if you were to go to an entire full-blown rulemaking thing. So, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of what I'm thinking right here, but I don't know what thoughts of the other committee members are. That's just my thoughts. So I like discussion, and I like cooperation. So hopefully you guys could come a little bit closer together on this. Although you're officially sort of like on the last bill, the last panel, neutral with concerns.
Yes.
So whatever that means.
Well, so Chair Edwards, maybe I can speak to that issue right there. I think we were very careful and wanted to be very clear with the committee by saying that we are neutral, because if we felt like we said anything else, it might undermine working collaboratively with the industry and the stakeholders on these, and we really wanted to convey that message to the committee that we want to have a serious conversation about how what we're doing can be improved. But that means we will agree, but we wanted to really try to seriously have that conversation. So we wanted to be very careful by saying that we're neutral. We didn't want to, sort of undermine the idea that we could try to make a serious run at this collaboratively.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Any other questions for panelists. Okay. Thank you all for being here. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 829 that did not sign up previously? Okay, seeing nobody else that wants to testify, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 829. And committee, I think that that concludes the committee. I think that that concludes the 29. And.